Father does not regard me with favor as he did. The God of my father has been with me. Now, skipping over to verse 29, we read, it is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. Verse 42, if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had not been at my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty handed. In verse 53, we see it says, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of your father, stood between us. And then lastly, in verse, chapter 36, verse 9, it says, and Jacob said, O God of my father, Abraham, the God of my father, Isaac. Stop there. So we can clearly see a pattern that refers to God as the God of his father rather than the God of himself. Until we get to verse 33, or chapter 33, verse 20, where it reads, there he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel, which means God, God of Israel, which is the first time ever that he refers to God as his own God. And we're going to take this concept of viewing God as God of our fathers and God as our God and apply that to lives of Christians growing up in Christian households. And we're going to apply that more specifically to our faith in God to start off. So when we are children, we're raised believing what we're going to do. Believing what our parents are doing. Like in my childhood, I was always taught about Jesus, what he did for us as sinners, and how he died on the cross for us. But that wasn't really my belief system. That was my parents' belief, and me believing what my parents said, rather than me believing in it myself. So we have to be cautious as to make sure that we are not believing what our parents believe, but believing what we have learned from God's Word. And now we're going to also shift over to personal convictions and how it can apply to our own personal convictions. Similarly to faith, our convictions can kind of lead into our parents. Like, for example, like drugs. If I were ever to be offered drugs, I would say no. Would that be because my dad would get mad at me, or would it be because I believe that the Lord would not have me to do that? Similarly, whether I go to church or not. I was raised obviously in church here, but do I go to church because my dad brings me to church, or should I be going to church because I have a desire and I have a conviction to go to church? And similarly, where I go to church, or which church I should be a part of. Do I go to church, or for example, do I go to this church because I was brought here as a kid, or you made me come here, or is it because I feel conviction to come to this church? The message we can take away is that we have to be sure that our convictions and our faith are from God, not from what we're brought up being taught.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well done. So thank you for going through that example of a pattern in the life of Jacob that can be seen and gleaned from the book of Genesis. We have sometimes parents and grandparents that are believers. Think about Jacob. The rascal that he is has Abraham for his grandfather and Isaac for his father. And what a legacy that is to be brought up. All right. Let's go to Genesis 37. And verse 3 and 4, we'll just take a quick recap of where we are in Joseph and Jacob. So Genesis 37, verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. And without going into great detail, last time we did notice that children born into the same family can be quite different from each other. And this was the case in Jacob's family. And he had a lot of sons that brought him a lot of heartache. The only four we read about in Genesis, we read about other things, other places, but details are given of Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And two of them are murderers. Two of them are sexually immoral. And these are Jacob's sons. This is what kind of children that he had. And through all of the heartache that they bring him over time, he in his old age has Joseph. And not only was he the son of Rachel, which already put him into disgrace, but he's so different from his other children. Different in such a delightful way. Although it's favoritism can cause problems in a family, you can almost see how it was easy to happen for Jacob. Because he looks at his sons, and every time he thinks about them as he's going to sleep, there are problems and issues and heartaches, and look at how they're turning out. Incidentally, by the end, they're going to turn out a lot better. But at least at this point, all of the problems that they're causing, and his mind goes to Joseph, and suddenly he has peace and delight. Joseph, what a boy he is. And it's a reflection of God the Father. As he looked down on Israel as a nation, all he saw were people that were money changers in the temple, taking the house of God and turning it into a den of thieves. He saw murderers, he saw immoral people, and then the religious Jews themselves had hearts of wickedness that the Lord Jesus would reveal later on. But it wasn't until God sent his son, born of a woman, into that nation where he could look down and he could see a soul in which his soul would delight. It was God the Father, Joseph, only with the Lord Jesus. And he would declare from heaven, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. So this is where Joseph found himself in Jacob's family, and it brought about the wrath of his brothers. Now, before we go on to see more about Joseph, I'd like to think about how young Joseph might have influenced Jacob. Because up until now, we've been really looking at how God is changing Jacob. He turned out, it started out as this supplanter, this rascal, this stealer, this cheater. And through the years, it's been a long, slow path to maturity. It's been a kind of a meandering path, if you will. You get signs as he's moving along. And as our brother Mike Anderson brought out the last time he spoke, you get instances and signs of his progression and changing through his life. But it was long and slow. But what what about Joseph? Joseph somehow got on the fast track to maturity. As a young man, he is more mature than Jacob was until Jacob got to be quite an old man. Let's look at the contrast of their two different paths to maturity. Jacob, if you remember, he left his father as a grown man. Joseph leaves his father as a youth when he's going to go out and check on his brothers. Jacob leaves fleeing his brothers. That's why he had to get out. Joseph leaves seeking his brothers. Jacob leaves for his own self-preservation. He wanted to make sure that he wasn't murdered by his brother Esau. Joseph leaves to consult his brother's welfare. Jacob left due to his own sin and his deception of his father, where Joseph left due to his obedience to his father. Jacob leaves in his state of soul is spiritually weak. He's not a strong believer. Joseph, on the other hand, is departing spiritually strong. And throughout Jacob's life after that, we have a slow and meandering path to maturity involving lots of God's discipline, not lots of God's tools to work Jacob into the believer he should be. But Joseph, on the other hand, he's mature and he's entrusted with all of Egypt at the age of 30. Now, why do I bring this out other than this interesting contrast? Is that you have to think that Jacob would have to be thinking about his own life and evaluating his life and evaluating the decisions he made. And no doubt, even before Joseph was born, Jacob had to be thinking, I wonder how my life would have turned out if I took a different track. In other words, instead of trying to cheat my way into blessing, what if I chose the path of trusting the Lord? Well, he could look back and say, well, I really don't know how life would have turned out that way because I didn't do it. I chose the path of cheating. And well, this is where God brought me up until now. But now he can look at Joseph. And he can see someone who was, even as a young man, mature and able to trust the Lord and able to be patient with things. Now, he, of course, as we know, will think that Joseph is killed at some point. But up until that point, Jacob is able to look at him and say, what a different life he is leading than the life I led at his age. And in fact, much older than his age. And how God could even use that in teaching him. So what I'd like to do now is look through chapters 37 and 39 a little bit and see some of the details of what happens to Joseph. I take it that we know the general idea of the story, that Joseph is trapped in the pit by his brothers, that he's brought up and sold to the Ishmaelites. They take him down to Egypt, and he's sold into Potiphar's household. And how well he does in Potiphar's household, and then how he's cast into prison from there. All right. So let's go and look at some of the details. Chapter 37, look down at verse 20. 37:20. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So when they have this murderous plot, Reuben decides he, for whatever reason, will try to preserve Joseph's life. Let's cast him into a pit, and the idea is he thought he could come back later, get him from the pit. And it says, deliver him to his father, which means perhaps he was trying to seek some good graces with his father, possibly. But anyway, it's interesting that of the sons, Reuben is the one who doesn't want to go through with the killing. Now, why this is interesting is it seems to be consistent character if you think back to the murders at Shechem. The murders at Shechem happened after Dinah was defiled, right, after she was raped. Who was it that committed the murders? Simeon and Levi, the second and third born. Now, you could understand perhaps why the later ones born would not be included. Maybe they were too young. But it is a little interesting, why wasn't the firstborn included? Reuben, he was certainly old enough. And yet, it seems from this little passage that Reuben might not have had it in him. Simeon and Levi probably knew that. Simeon and Levi hatched this plan. You could almost hear him, right? Should we include Reuben? Don't include Reuben. He doesn't have it enough. He doesn't have the stuff. We're going to have to do this ourselves. And here's his character coming out. Now, Reuben had his own problems of sexual immorality, which we read about elsewhere. But as far as the vile, sadistic ability in killing, it doesn't seem to be part of Reuben's makeup. And it's interesting to see these details and these consistencies through the scriptures. The next thing to note is if you look down at verse 28, when Joseph is brought out of the pit, Judah says, wait a minute, we're not going to make anything off of him if we just kill him. Let's sell him. Verse 27, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Not our hands dipped on him, for he is our brother in our flesh. And his brothers listen. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelite for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Now, if you notice, there is this call to sell him to the Ishmaelites, and then this statement in verse 28 about Midianite traders. This, believe it or not, causes great concern for some people, which I don't know why. Later we read about in the Bible that the Midianites and Ishmaelites were blended together. There's no reason why that the same group of people could not be referred to as both Ishmaelites and Midianites, and probably emphasizing Midianites being that they were from Midian, the land, and Ishmaelites being where they were descended from, more so. But they're used interchangeably later, but I've seen some really scratch their heads that there were two groups of caravans, one the Ishmaelites, the other the Midianites, and how this becomes a very complicated thing. But there's no reason not to assume that these are just the same two names for the same group of people. Now, after Joseph is sold, the brothers now have to go to their father. So what happens? Verse 31. So they took Joseph's tunic and killed the kid of the goats and dipped the tunic in blood. Then they sent the tunic in many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. You know whether it is your son's tunic or not. Now I'll ask what a brother can ask. Why is it interesting that they used a goat to kill and dip the tunic in the blood, as opposed to any other animal? Any brother wants to explain why that's interesting. Well, they're going to deceive their father. The brothers of Joseph are going to deceive their father, and they're going to use a goat that they've killed to do it. If you remember what happened with Jacob earlier in life, when Jacob had to deceive his father, he had to make his arms hairy because he was a smooth guy. So he killed a goat and used the goat hair to deceive his father. This, I take it, is included. This detail is included. Not just killed an animal and put the blood on it, but it says killed a goat and put the blood on it to make us make that connection. In other words, God maturing of Jacob and putting Jacob through needed trials sometimes, he's going to have his Jacob's sons deceive their father the same way he deceived his father? And if Joseph Jacob had not been mulling this over throughout his life up until now, you know he had to now, because they come and they show him this coat of many colors. They say, look, what is this, his coat? What could have happened to it? Now, Jacob, of course, couldn't know that it was a blood from a goat, from human blood or any other animal blood. But the detail seems to be included for us to make that connection. But I take it that Jacob had to think that he might be being deceived. Now, Jacob had no way of knowing Joseph was alive. But I have a feeling Jacob, knowing how easy it is for some of his sons to commit murder, and knowing their hatred of their brother, may have suspected, well, I think he's dead. But I doubt it was a goat. I doubt it was a wild animal. I wonder if it was even them. But of course, he would never be able to find out. His sons and his daughters go to comfort him. They refuse to be comforted. He said, go down to my grave, to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Verse 37. Come now, we're going to read verse 36 and then skip chapter 38. Verse 36. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And we'll come over to 39 to find how Joseph did there under Potiphar. Now it's interesting to notice the preparation that God puts Joseph through. You know, why could Joseph not have had a fast track to Pharaoh's house to be interpreting Pharaoh's dream and be the leader of Egypt? One of the things that Joseph had to do was learn the language of Egypt. So he goes, not knowing the language of Egypt, he goes into Egypt and serves in Potiphar's house. And in that time, he's learning the language. He'll also learn the language while he's in prison, maybe some other words of the Egyptian language. And then he is ready to serve before Pharaoh. Now, we know that there are different languages, and they're not intelligible to each other, because later when Joseph's brothers come to Egypt, he uses an interpreter to speak through them, because he doesn't want to let on to the brothers that he knows their language, and they don't understand his language. So they are definitely different languages. So God, in his preparation, will send Joseph to Potiphar's house for time, for years, he will be there. Now look down in chapter 39, and let's look at verse 3. And his master, that is Potiphar, saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had put, all under his authority. So it was, from the time that he had made him the overseer of his house, and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. We'll stop there. What an expression, that he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate, meaning that Joseph was so faithful, so reliable, so good at managing his household that Potiphar no longer had to think about anything except what he wanted to eat that day. That's all he had to think. Everything was prospering. And in fact, I take it that as Potiphar went along, he realized, you know, the more Joseph handles, the better things get. Until he just gave it him everything. You manage it all. I'm just going to wake up in the morning, decide what I want to eat, and live my life. That's like, it's some kind of life. You know, it's the idea, you know, somebody wakes up and wins Powerball or something like that. But it's better, because you have Joseph and his wisdom to manage things. And God blessed Potiphar for Joseph's sake. Now, Joseph finds himself going from a lowly slave to being the manager of Potiphar's house. Now, we understand Potiphar was not just a merely some rich guy somewhere in Egypt. If you look back at the end of chapter 37, remember the verse we read. Now, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Potiphar was not some, you know, lowly, mildly rich person that could afford a servant. Potiphar was, it was a big operation, and to make Joseph head over all of that, Joseph was managing quite a bit of things, and his wisdom is shown in everything that he does. Now, Joseph is elevated to second in charge, overtake Potiphar himself, but managed everything. He'll later be thrown into prison, and then he's going to be discovered by Pharaoh, and he's going to rise again to second in charge, aside from Pharaoh himself, and manage everything. Do you know anybody else like this? He went to the lowly spot, and was then put in, he rose in the ranks to second in charge. And then this happened again, and he rose in ranks to second in charge. I'm thinking of, I'm not making a reference to the Lord yet at this point, I'm thinking of Daniel. If you remember what happened to Daniel, Daniel was taken from his home as a slave, transported far away where they spoke another language, and he rose in the ranks because of his faithfulness and that God was with him. And he rose in the ranks, and for interpreting a dream, rose in the ranks to second in charge next to Nebuchadnezzar. And then Nebuchadnezzar was taken over by the Medes and Persians. Well, so much for Daniel's rank at that point. And yet we find that he rose in the ranks under the Persians to be second in charge as well. What a testimony and a comparison. I'd like to look at these for a moment. Joseph and Daniel together. We've already said some of the comparisons, but it's very interesting. Both of them are described as handsome, and they're bright, even in their youth. Both are transported to foreign lands as slaves. Both have visions and interpretations of dreams. They both interpret dreams for the ruler. Joseph will for Pharaoh, Daniel does for Nebuchadnezzar. They both point out that the interpretation is from God and not themselves, and that's an interesting detail that's in both of the accounts. Both rise to second in command under Gentile rule twice. Joseph actually might do it a third time, because Joseph, after being second in command under Potiphar's house, gets thrown into prison, where the prison guard eventually sees how good he is and how faithful he is, and he kind of is second in command under him in the prison, and then second in command under Pharaoh. Both are appointed over the whole kingdom of a sole world power. So this is not being the second in command over some 40 square mile country. I mean, this was a sole world power, Babylon at its time and Egypt at its time, at least after the famine. Egypt was a sole world power. Both are given new Gentile names when they are taken into their new surroundings. Now, Daniel's was in a negative way. He was given a name after an ungodly idol, this false god, but Joseph was given a name that was much more honorable to him. Interestingly, there's this fine detail that both are given a gold chain around their neck. It's fascinating. Both had impeccable character. I'm not saying we can never find a flaw in Joseph, but by and large, they both are recorded as having impeccable characters. Both are envied by their peers Joseph, his brothers, and Daniel, the other administrators that were alongside Daniel. Both lives are plotted against due to that envy. They wanted to do away with Daniel. Daniel was too good of a guy. And the other administrators wanted to do away with him. And same with his Joseph's brothers. He's too good of a guy. Let's get rid of him. Both are thrown into a pit for dead. Pretty fascinating, these comparisons. Both are drawn from the pit and are exalted above the perpetrators. It's really a fascinating comparison. These two characters, both of them, by the way, are pictures of Christ. Joseph definitely to a greater extent. Now, practically, what do we gain from this? How does this change our lives, knowing all of this? I'm not sure. But it does give us indication that the Bible is put together not as a haphazard collection of unrelated books, not put together by man of, you know, these legends, these stories, and we'll throw them together into one volume of books, but the Bible has very deliberate themes that run through the Bible. It is one book, even though it is comprised of several individual books. And this comparison doesn't stand alone. This comparison then has further applications and revelations of the life of Christ himself. Okay. We'll stop this study at this point. If a brother has a final comment. Yeah, and I think there's a fair possibility that Jacob knew his sons had made up some of this story, but I think that Jacob would have had to assume that they were covering up probably a murder rather than covering up rather than the fact that Joseph could possibly be alive.